Okay, folks, a couple of things before we get started. So the initial, I sent you the mail. We looked at the stuff that you guys wrote about the initial project ideas. Some of you have more ideas, some of you have, you know, probably not yet have much of an idea. But I know that, I mean, this was part of the deal. I understand that if you wait until you have an idea, the course is over. And so basically, it's trying to get you to converge faster. And rather than make up your mind, you know, ask you to make up your mind in isolation, we were just saying, based on whatever keywords you used, we found who is the closest person among the TAs and myself who could potentially talk to you. And then after talking to them, then you might decide either that, yeah, those keywords are still my most interesting thing. Like, you know, if somebody said dynamic planning, or somebody said replanning, or somebody said heuristics. You know, we picked somebody, you know, among the four of us, myself, Jay, Will, and Menkes. Okay, all of, and then Sangwook, five. All of us have ICAPS papers, so which basically means we know at least how to do some of the work in automated planning, and we have different specializations. And so, in fact, while we don't cover all of planning, it was a reasonable subset of planning that we covered. And so, actually, you guys too, there were a reasonable, given that it's a small sample, there was a reasonable spread in terms of ideas that people were interested in. So we gave some names. I mean, in fact, I think a couple of them already knew what they were doing, and the couple for the others, basically, if you see under your name, there's like a bid for initial advisor. Some of them have two names, some of them have one name. The basic idea is that you connect, you contact the first bid person. Okay, so I guess in this guy's case, Jay Benton. Jonathan will contact Jay Benton, okay? And set up a meeting this week. Okay, so essentially you get to set up the meeting so that you can, you know, since there is not everybody is available at any specific time, it would be easiest if you set up a meeting with that person, and then you should at least talk once this week. Maybe lots of things will happen based on that, maybe nothing will happen, you know, but at least, you know, you would have a chance to, you know, get an idea of what you can do to flesh out the topic, okay? And also, now that this is over, basically what we're going to do is for all, each of you will maintain a wiki page there. So each of these will probably become a separate page, and then you keep track of a summary. You know, if whenever you meet, you know, you need to make a summary, okay? So I'm just trying to force some structure into essentially an unstructured thing. You know, research is, it doesn't really matter what you do as long as you got the great idea and wrote it up. You know, it doesn't matter whether you did one nth of the great idea for n of the days, or you screwed around for all n minus 1 days, and, you know, last day, just before 1 minute to go, you got the great idea, you implemented it, you checked it, it was great, you wrote it up. Okay, that's really how the world works. Okay, however, we are trying to sort of enforce some structure to this so that in case finally nothing happens, at least I would know that you have made an effort, you learned something, even if you didn't advance some state of the art. Okay, that's the basic idea. Okay, so that's the deal. I'm assuming that you all know how to contact these people. I should probably also send that. I think I already sent the email addresses of the people, the five of us. But if not, I'll send an email again. If you have trouble, just send me an email. But before that, if I remember, I'll send a mail to the class list giving all the email addresses. Okay? So that's the thing. And another thing is, this is, you are not bound to an advisor here. This is sort of to help you. So you might decide after talking to the initial advisor that, you know, this is not going anywhere. I think I'm smarter than I'm smarter about what I want to do than whatever these people are trying to give. In which case, you just need to let me know, okay? And then you would be on your own, which is fine, okay? So this is trying to help you, not trying to get in your way, okay? So if it is becoming more of a getting in your way, that's fine, okay? Any questions on this stuff? None? Okay. And then the project one is ready. I just basically, as I said last time, essentially it's just this silly thing of trying to write your own oh, it doesn't like me. Okay. Project. So there's only one project, and you know, again, all it requires is you think of some problem that you think can be written as a planning problem, preferably something that isn't already in the benchmark, and then write an English description of the domain, write a PDL description of the domain. At this point, I assume you'll only write a deterministic domain, because that's the only thing that we have talked about till now. Okay, and then generate at least 5 problems of varying complexity for your domain, if that is possible. Test the problems on an existing planner that can eat PDDL. And there are several of these, depending on if you want like the widest possible coverage, in particular with the conditional effects and so on, you might want to try FF. I think it has conditional effects thrown in. Okay, so it can handle quantified and conditional effects. Okay. Again, I think in the code page, code for the planners page, you have details. I mean, I think you have actually downloadables of the planners for Linux binaries, but you can also get the binaries from the web pages directly of the planners. Okay, if you want, for example, FF down, you know, binary, you just say FF and Hoffman, who is the author. Okay. So that's the thing. So, but even before you get there, mostly what you need to do is actually to think of a domain and write it in PDDL. What's interesting is, and I also actually want to know, if you thought of a domain in particular, if you thought of a domain which you thought should be considered planning, but PDDL really was not the best way to model it, write it. Explain what were the things in the domain that you had to throw away so that you could use this Procrustean bed, which is basically this PDDL language. Yes?
Single agent or multi-agent?
Right now, we are basically doing classical planning, which is single agent deterministic planning. Okay. That's all we are doing right now. Okay. Now, you could do other things, but as you go out of this security blanket, there aren't even planners that can eat, you know, your domains. You know, many of the other planners are research prototypes. Okay. FF is a research prototype too, but at least it's been, you know, it's been worked on long enough that I think it's reasonably bug-free, okay, and it eats PDDL. There are several other planners like FF, but their binaries probably are not as easily available. In fact, you know, it's not any longer the fastest deterministic planner, but that's not what you're really looking for. In doing this, what you're really looking for is what are the issues involved in taking something that you think should be called a planning domain and trying to write it in terms of these effect preconditions framework. It turns out that there would be usually problems in modeling that. Okay, so you are the domain modeler at this point. Okay? And then I have a couple of these. I might actually extend this list. There were a bunch of people who have written, but although not all of these are deterministic planning problems, these are a bunch of papers that look at PDL or extensions to deal with different kinds of planning problems. Okay, that might give you an idea. But some of them are not, as I said. This particular one, for example, is not, oh no, this is actually a direct PDL problem. This one is a probabilistic PDL, I believe. So, you know, it'll give you some ideas as to what people have done, but I think it's mostly for you to try and write it in. Okay. And I put in a deadline of February 14th, which is 2 weeks from now. Okay. Okay, and also note-taking has been suspended because of the underwhelming interest and demand. We will basically go with just the slides and on the paper reading. And I'll make, and those of you who did do the note taking earlier on, I'll find some way of rewarding you, like such as if you need like an extra day, extension that I'm not giving anybody else, I might give you. Okay, something like that. Okay. So today we are going to do heuristics for planning, and you read the paper, right? So questions. I know that several of you who did the 471 already know first parts of that paper. Basically, it's essentially the same using reachability heuristics for at least pushing forward state, I mean, progression and regression planners. Of course, this paper also goes into details about bunch of other planning techniques. It also deals with progression, regression, plan space planning. It also deals with negative interactions, which we didn't do in 471. And then, of course, it goes off into cost-based planning, partial satisfaction planning. And so in some sense, rest of it, you would once in a while go back to it. Once we do temporal planning, we'll go back and look at how the heuristics are handled for temporal planning. And once we do non-deterministic planning, we'll go back and look at what you do for heuristics for that. Okay, that's the basic idea. So it's sort of a cross-sectional paper, but the first several pages that I asked you to read are a good background on what most of the current planners do for heuristics. Okay. So what is the, are there any questions or, yes?
So when you were talking about for plan space planning in specific, and you mentioned that by assuming that negative interactions do not exist, in essence for plan space planning, negative interactions are unsafe links, right?
Mm.
So why would this be a better? Aren't you losing informedness?
But you're losing informedness.
No. But in plan space planning, in partial auto planning, for example, already have a way which considers both open conditions and unsafe links. So this would seem like not a way forward that you're actually losing.
No, but this is a heuristic. This is a heuristic,
right,
to decide which plan to pick. But there are also other ideas. For example, you can use the negative interactions to consider the indirect conflict. Okay, that is part of the deal too. But in general, there is no reason to believe that negative interactions, I mean, it's possible that ignoring negative interactions would be a bigger deal for plan space planning than it is for progression planning, okay? But I don't know whether it will be a bigger deal for plan space planning than it is for regression planning, for example.
No, okay? I think what I'm saying is for progression planning, progression planning, at least you're not handed the negative interaction at once, but the way the plan space planning is defined,
No. You don't actually. All you know is, here's the interesting thing. Suppose there is S1, it's giving P to S2, okay, and S3 is giving Q. Is there an interaction according to plan space planning? I don't know. If, on the other hand, if I know that P and Q are mutually exclusive, it is an interaction. So don't assume that things are given free to you, okay? If the way you are talking, basically in regression planning too, suppose I try to work on P and Q together, is that feasible or not? I don't know. But if on the other hand, if I have to try and work on P and not P together, I can see that it's not feasible.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's not that, you know, that the basic search techniques are not any more, you know, informed than each other. They're just looking at different ways of, you know, traversing the search space. Yes?
So now you said that the basic techniques are not that different, but in the paper there's something that, and it's kind of trying to show that mutexes kind of help progression much more than.
Yes. So the idea is, again, in terms of progression planning, when it's going forward, right, you already are going in the space of legal states. Okay, you are always going in the space of legal states. So that argument essentially is, you have progression planners which go forward, and then for them, if you have a state, if you are considering multiple states that you can expand it to, right? I mean, there are the children's states and you're trying to decide which one to go forward on. And the way forward progression planners have to work is they need to construct a planning graph for each of these states, compute the relaxed plan with respect to each of these, pick the one which is the shortest relaxed plan. Okay? You would think this should be considerably costly compared to regression, where you just start with a single goal state and all you have is one planning graph. Okay, you basically are using the same single planning graph, and because the initial state is not changing, it's the goal state which keeps moving forward. And the assumption would then be that somehow, in terms of the heuristic computation cost, regression planners should win hands down. They do, if you only consider the heuristic computation cost. Okay, but the total cost of planning is the computation for the heuristic plus the computation for the search. And what happens essentially is in the regression planners, if you don't take negative interactions into account, you're more likely to wind up expanding failing state. Okay, so the idea is that here when you're going forward, you are essentially, because they're completely defined actions, you are in legal space. You're essentially you may not be going towards the goal state, but the partial plan that you have, okay, especially if you have these ergodic, in the sense that there are no deadlines. If you have a planning domain where Black's world is a classic case, where really you can always go from any state to any state. Okay, so in a sense, you always go towards the goal. Even if you're going away, you can always come back, you know, without backtracking away from that path. Okay, so yeah, I mean, it's not exactly the case that all search algorithms are. So they are looking at the space in different ways. Okay, but all I was saying in response to him was, it's not that somehow plan space planners know much more about negative interactions. They just know the straightforward negative interaction, you know, P and not P. But they don't know P and Q. And that's just as important. Yes? What happens? You basically, there is an idea, for example, where you can, so first of all, if you have mutexes, then, let me actually show you the slide. Okay, so without mutexes, this is the slide, right? I mean, this is again, these are pictures directly from the paper. So set level essentially says, look for the first level where all the literals are present. Okay, look for the first level where all the literals are present. Now, if you have negative interactions, all you are saying is, look for the first level where all the literals are present and have not already been proved to be impossible together. Okay. The fact that they have not been proved to be impossible together doesn't mean they're actually possible. Okay, so here you have, in some sense, here you said, I completely ignored negative interactions. So as far as my analysis is considered, it's possible to get these five literals in this level. But then if I have done, let's say, binary mutex analysis, I might find that two of these five literals are marked mutually exclusive in this level, which means I can't actually get all five of them. I have to go forward further. Okay, and the other important thing to remember is, even if you completely did the binary mutex analysis, which in itself is actually an oxymoron, because it turns out that you will never actually be able to get all binary mutexes. If you do the simple kind of propagation of binary mutexes, that whatever it says is mutually exclusive is mutually exclusive. But there are many other things that are not marked as mutually exclusive, but are mutually exclusive. In fact, the problem for that is because when you're doing binary mutexes, you're only considering two things at a time that are not feasible together. Right? Now, suppose But you won't consider three things that are not feasible together, for example. That will be the ternary mutexes. Okay? Now, what's interesting is that I can always make, so if I have an action A1 which requires P and Q, suppose it turns out that PQ or QR or PR can all be done. But you can't do P, Q, and R together. Suppose you know this, but your mutex propagation algorithm doesn't know it because it will only consider P. Okay? So then, suppose I wrote an A1 which gives M, and I have an A2 which gives N. So I now actually know that since all these three cannot be true in any state, it's not possible to do A1 and A2 together to get M and N together. So these higher order mutexes actually led to a binary mutex, which you will miss. Okay? First thing. Because of this connection between levels, in fact, after doing binary mutex propagation, not only would you not have computed all binary mutexes, you would also not have computed all unary mutexes. A unary mutex is that this thing should not be present in this level. Right? Because nobody can give it. Right? Now, all I need to do to make it a unary mutex that I miss is to make A star which takes P, Q, and R and gives W. Now, W should not be present. If this is the only action that can give W, W should not be put in the next level because A star is actually not feasible. But binary mutexes won't tell you that. Okay. Now, so that's one point, subtle point. The second point is that if you have multiple, so if you do binary as well as ternary mutex propagation, okay, somehow you did this, let's say, okay, or somebody gave it to you, for example, you could improve the negative set level. This is basically, let me see. So all we are saying in this particular case is have soil and add something, and this is gone because I just removed that font, unfortunately. I can put it back. Add something, I forget. These two actually are marked mutually exclusive at this level. By the next level, they are not marked mutually exclusive, so you consider their level to be 2 but not 1. Okay, but if you also have marked ternary mutexes, okay, then all you are looking at is to consider if you have a set of literals, set of n literals, you want to check in the current level if any subset of this set of literals is marked mutually exclusive. If so, you give up. So that means there is at least a subset of things, not just binary, could be ternary, could be, 4 array mutex, 4 array, 4 set, 4 subset, which is cannot be done together, in which case the entire set dies. So you need to go to the next level. Okay. Now to improve the, let me get rid of this annoying thing. It will be useful to see what you're saying. To improve the informedness of the heuristic, you need to why not? Oh, it still doesn't show up. So I went through this whole thing. Now you actually can't see even more things. Seems like. Yeah, so there is unfortunately a font there in the in the web in that PowerPoint that that you can't see. Okay, just killing it. So to improve the negative interactions analysis, you have to consider basically improving the propagation, not just for binary mutexes, but also higher order mutexes. And doing higher order mutex propagation turns out to be costlier. Okay, and so for the regression guy to win over progression guy, in essence, one possible way is to intelligently do higher order mutex propagation. Okay, or at least do it demand driven. So in fact, one idea is if you did fail on a subset trying to achieve them, then you can try to remember that, and that would give you a higher order mutex. Okay, other questions? Yes.
I couldn't understand the difference between maps and set levels. There was an example where I think maps software.
Okay, so maps and set level, it's a very good point. Maps and set level are one and the same if you do not take negative interactions into account.
But even if you do, why can't you apply the same thing for the second class, the set level? Except for maps, you can take into account mutexes.
No, maps essentially is. Max heuristic is saying if I have n literals, then I act as if all of them are independent, okay? And then look at the largest level, any of these guys. I mean, largest level you need to go to for any of them to become true, okay? So if I have P, Q, and R, P becomes true by first level, Q becomes true by second level, R becomes true by third level, the max would be 3. And the sum would be 1 plus 2 plus 3. Okay, now set level would also be 3 because the set comes into being as soon as the last arriving guy comes into being. But then if you have the mutual exclusions thrown in, they may have come in individually, but they are not still together as a set. So when you have mutual exclusions, then max is different from set level. Yeah, so I mean it's like a question of, no, you could say why can't I define such that there's only that basically set level and max would do the same thing. Okay, you can do that, but it actually is cheaper to compute max heuristic. Okay, and furthermore, in fact, so between it is cheaper to compute max heuristic because you're only looking at individual literals. Okay, rather than looking at the whole set. You'll be ignoring the mutexes. You might know mutexes in the following way. Suppose you're taking the mutexes into account and W is one of the literals. Now if you didn't bring it in because the actions preconditions are already marked mutex, then it won't even have come in. So it means you can at least take unary mutexes. It's max, but you won't take any higher order mutex. Okay, I'm not necessarily saying that. In fact, max heuristic, the one advantage of max heuristic and set level heuristic are that they are admissible. Okay, this is very important from the search point of view. An admissible heuristic means if you're talking about, you know, what is the length of the plan to go from the current state to the goal state, and the heuristic is giving you an estimate. As long as that estimate is not greater than, as long as that estimate is not greater than the real length, optimal length, then using this heuristic as part of a star search, you will never miss finding the optimal solution. So the way a star search is written, as soon as it picks a node from the goal queue, from the open list, and it's a goal node, it can stop, knowing that it will be optimal, as long as the heuristic it's using is admissible. And of all the heuristics that we look at in this paper, the set level and the max are admissible. Okay? The sum is not admissible, because sum assumes essentially that everything is if you have P, Q, and R, some heuristic is assuming that they're all independent. Okay? If they have positive interactions, then it would wind up overestimating the cost. Positive interactions means that P and Q really require the same single action to make true. In which case you would be counting that action once per P, once per Q, and so you overcount it. Okay? So the admissibility, as far as the optimality of search is concerned, you need admissibility. After all, and for the admissibility, the max and set level heuristics are good. Okay. Now, how about the relaxed plan heuristic? So the relaxed plan heuristic is actually, if you know what your goals are, right? If you remember. What it's trying to do is pick an action from this level pick a set of actions from this level to support each of these conditions. And as soon as you pick those actions, you would then have to pick actions in the previous level, the preconditions in the previous level, those which are the preconditions of the actions that you chose, and then you do this recursively. And you have to stop by the end because there is a finite recursion. Okay? And this is backtrack free in the sense you will never be forced to backtrack. Okay? You can always find a set of actions here and a set of actions here and a set of actions here such that if you execute them all, and if in fact there are no negative interactions, you would get these conditions. Okay? Now the problem, of course, is it's still not admissible. The reason it's not admissible is that there may be multiple sets of actions that can be chosen here to support these conditions. And you have to, even though all of them will work, the optimal one, to find out the optimal one, you still need to get through all sets. Okay? So in fact, you can show that finding the optimal relaxed plan is NP complete. But if you do find the optimal relaxed plan, then it will be an admissible heuristic. And it will be a very nice admissible heuristic. It's nicer than set level. Yes? I mean, it's nicer than set level without negative interaction. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
No. This guy is, remember this whole thing is being done to figure out what to do. So there is the search level and there is a heuristic level. So during search, at some point of time, let's say you essentially try to expand this state, S1, you got S11, S12, S13. And you're trying to figure out which of them to expand next. Assume there is nobody else. Okay, these are the three children of your root node. You're trying to figure out which one to expand next. Okay, so you need a heuristic value as to how far are they from the goal state. To compute that, for each of them, you computed a planning graph of that kind. And within that, you are extracting a relaxed plan. Okay, and you can do that greedily if you don't care about admissibility. And then suppose if the number of actions there are 5, then that means the cost of this is 5. So this is all at the heuristic level.
Yeah, but since we don't backtrack in this heuristic plan with heuristic, what if we chose not good action at the very beginning?
Yeah.
Then we'll get some heuristic.
So then what you have basically is it's an inadmissible heuristic. So that's all. Okay, so you would no longer be sure of optimality. Okay, yes? So again, this is the picture. So this is the picture that you have to remember, right? I mean, and again, several of you have seen this. If in A star you have nodes here, and this is your H star, which is the perfect heuristic. Okay, anything below is admissible. Okay, and to be admissible, you have to be below it. To be informed, you want to be as close to H star as possible. And overestimating, underestimating normally is the way heuristic becomes uninformed. Okay, if you take H equal to 0, you would completely underestimate. You will never be above the perfect heuristic. So H equal to 0 is uniform cost search or breadth first search, and that's admissible, right? Again, one of the interesting things, so there are people, I mean, there is currently, you know, in planning, one of the weird things is that in the competition, for example, there are two different tracks, one for just plans and other for optimal plans. Okay, now of course in the plans competition, they would still compare different competing planners in terms of how fast they got done and how good were their plans in terms of the number of actions. But they don't have to certify that they are optimal. In optimal planning, you have to certify. If you open your mouth, you have to certify it's optimal. And so there's one part is taken care of. You don't need to compare the length of the plans between two optimal planners because they're both optimal, so they're both having the same exact length. So all you need to compare is the time they take. And you know that currently the size of the problems that can be solved optimally is orders of magnitude smaller. Not orders of magnitude. It's much smaller, okay, because the optimal search, you know, search with admissible heuristics, is much costlier even now. So there is optimality track, and basically, in fact, I don't think there exists any planner which actually directly computes the optimal relaxed plan efficiently and uses it to find the optimal plan, although that's an obviously reasonable idea to do. One other thing on this relaxed plan thing, I guess, where is it?
It doesn't
make it
relaxed, or is it working for them?
What?
It doesn't make it have a plan
which computes optimal relaxed plans, or is it working for them? He basically also does not compute optimal relaxed plans. He doesn't solve the IP encoding, but this is offline. I mean, I can't make sense of it to them. Yeah, so that's what I was trying to show, which is, I wrote it somewhere here. Okay, this. So this is a slide to remember. So in the relaxed plan heuristics, when the level does not, okay, first of all, you should remember these pictures, right? Level-based heuristics break because, in essence, sometimes you might say, my plan is one level long, but within that level, you put in 1,000 actions. Okay, it's one level, but it's 1,000 actions. So you can easily generate plans where, so for example, this one would be, so whereas if you consider the relaxed plan, it actually counts the number of actions in the plan. And so that takes care of that problem. Okay, so when level does not reflect distance well, we can find the relaxed plan. Okay. But finding the optimal relaxed plan is NP-hard. Okay. Finding a greedy relaxed plan can be made anywhere between cheap to slightly costly to slightly costlier to NP-hard, depending on how less greedy you want. Okay. In particular, one of the things you do is as you extend these ideas to cost-based planning, for example, where you have actions have cost, okay, then you would not just consider any action to support the goal, but you try to consider those actions which are expected to have low cost based on the propagation up until that point. Okay, that still winds up being a greedy approach, because the only way of making sure that it is the cheapest cost plan which ignores negative interactions is to run through all possible, essentially in the worst case, run through all possible subgraphs here. And so that winds up being NP-hard. Okay. So you will see later on that you can be less greedy, or at least take the context of the problem into account in picking the actions in the relaxed planning. For example, you can take cost of the action into account. Okay. Yes.
And I grasp it seems like at least with the heuristics we discussed that we're more or less kind of, except from the construction and then the music, those we're kind of ignoring the structure of the graph, the edges.
Mm-hmm.
Is there insight to be gained from the edges, like how connected a certain proposition is to a certain action, or how many connections an action has coming into it at a certain level, or things like that?
So it's actually, there is that kind of analysis that's done. So if you consider, so by, even though you wound up reading this paper, and this actually probably represents about 80% of planners which do heuristics, okay, and they, most of them wind up doing planning graph-based heuristics. But there are other types, okay. In particular, you can take the some of the different, there's a different kind of analysis you can do which involves this domain transition graphs. We will do that later on. But even within the planning graphs, one thing that the edges can help, and I don't think anybody has tried it, is you can talk about how likely is something to be mutually exclusive. Let's see. Okay. So one of the things about mutual exclusion is here, for example, so you started by saying these two actions, I need a new battery, these two actions, sample and drive, are marked mutually exclusive, right? And then, so these two propositions are marked mutually exclusive if every way of making this proposition true is mutually exclusive with every way of making this one true. So if there are m establishers, so that means if m edges coming into this proposition and n edges coming into this proposition, you need to have m times n actions marked mutually exclusive in the worst case before you can say these two are mutually exclusive. Okay, if m is large and n is large, and you essentially have mn minus 2 pairs are marked mutex, but those two pairs are not marked mutex. You don't differentiate in this case, because essentially you will say that this is, you know, it's not mutually exclusive. Okay, so you can talk about the notion of mutual exclusion, so the degree of mutual exclusion, okay, that essentially winds up taking the edge structure into account. So that's one idea. I couldn't offhand think of others, but that's one possible idea. Yes. Not to my knowledge, because we'll get to hierarchical planners and we'll point out that essentially the hierarchical planners that seem to be working well are specialized pieces of code for a particular domain. And so already you put everything you know about the domain, including do this first and then do this and then do this. So it's hard to compete with heuristics at that point. Okay. So as far as I know, that there isn't any need for heuristics there for the kind of shop-like planners.
Yeah, like what if all HTNs are not complete? So they need someone else.
No, so the classical hierarchical task network plans, which again we have to come back here and discuss, you know, I think you just happen to know that more. There you can use these heuristics because they wind up being partial order planners with action disjunction thrown in. And so you can use them for HTN planning just as you can use them for partial order planning. But nobody actually does. I mean, there are no active prototypes of these HTN planners out there right now. So, I mean, the ones that are available are the ones which basically somebody almost completely domain engineers. and, you know, gets the planet to the correct direction. And since you are there, you know, you are the richest uncle out there. So, I mean, I think of heuristics as rich uncles, and, you know, if you are ready to give away how to do the problem, I think you might not need this kind of analysis as much. Other questions? Does that mean that we are done with this topic and we move on to the next one? I'm trying to run a real graduate course, so I'm trying to see when we can assume that it's done. Let me say a few things. We still have some time, a lot of time. So let me say a few more things. Maybe starting from the beginning and quickly passing by to make sure that we are all on the same page. Okay, so this slide is to show that pretty much everything you know about progression, regression, and plan space planning was known several years back, you know, at least 1990s, early 1990s and before. Okay, what was not known is how to make these planners go fast, and so basically what's good heuristics for them. Okay, so this was sort of a sort of showing you that it's this rocket problem where rockets are on the Earth and you need to take them to the Moon and you need to take some packages to the Moon through these rockets, and these are one-way rockets. And so once they go to the Moon, if they haven't put the package in, they have to come back and they can't come back. Okay, that's the basic idea. And so the question is, how much can you go in terms of what's the length of the plan that you can solve within reasonable time limits? Okay. And then basically all of them used to be, you know, as you can see, all of them are exponential. Even now, things are exponential. You know, the basic underlying exponential nature doesn't go away unless your heuristic has constant difference, okay, very small constant difference to the perfect heuristic. Okay, most heuristics will basically be just reducing the size of the exponent. So it's still a exponent, it's just a slower raising exponent. Okay. One thing that we can do now, of course, is larger problems, hundreds of actions. You know, there are some domains where, you know, so these are the tasks in something called an airport domain, and I think the number of actions corresponding to that is close, you know, is not actually number of tasks, it's more, it's about four times that. Okay. So you can get pretty long, deep, long plans, and length of the plan in most cases is the depth of the search space. And you're talking about B power D. Okay, as the depth increases, you are going exponentially more work. Okay, so you can do these kinds of problems. One thing that somebody, I showed this somewhere recently, and a systems guy said, you know, you really should make sure that you have normalized this for the speed of the machines in 90s versus now, which is a good point. I believe that doesn't change anything, but the, you know, one of these days this slide needs to be changed such that they are in the same CPU cycles, you know, let's say 2007 CPU cycles. Okay, so way to improve planner scalability, you looked at mostly the reachability heuristics. Let's see. Okay, so how many people had any questions about, if there's any questions about this, I can go slower, otherwise, you know, it's like, it's probably some of you have already heard about this. So the planning graph is cheaper than the progression tree. Okay, so the simplest, the dumbest way which would work to compute how costly, how far is this from the goal state, is to start the search from here until you reach the goal state and find the path, and that would give you the heuristic. Okay, obviously it's a dumb idea because you're doing search to do search. Okay, so what the planning graph can be thought of as is basically it's sort of an envelope structure of the progression tree. Okay, so rather than considering each action in a different branch, you are thinking all the actions can be done together. And if they can be done together, all their effects can be made true together. If so, then all the actions which depend on those effects can be done together, and so on. Okay, so you can actually construct this without constructing that. Of course, if you construct that first, then you have lost it already, because you wasted all your time already. So, but this can be constructed by essentially in linear time. Okay, so that's the deal with this graph, and what this gives you is a lower bound on achievability, right? Because if some particular condition is, I mean, a proposition is actually true at a particular level, I mean, it's not true in a particular level, then you know for sure that there is no plan which can get you there in those many levels. But if the proposition is there, then that doesn't mean that there is actually a plan. Okay, that's why it's a lower bound. Okay, and knowing that you know, something is at least 2, I mean, so the cost of a literal is at least 2 or more is useful, because that will give you admissible heuristic. That will give you heuristic in particular. And now for a single literal, it looks as if that's going to be admissible. But really, what you need to talk about is how to combine, if you have a bunch of literals together, how to combine the cost of achieving each of them to compute the cost of the set. And that's what we were talking about, the set level heuristic, the summation heuristic, okay, and the max heuristic. Okay, and they have different properties. Max is admissible, sum is not, but sum is actually always larger than max. Right? Yeah. You know, sum is likely to be larger than max, and so it's going to be closer to the perfect heuristic. Sometimes it might be above the perfect heuristic, but the larger your heuristic value is, the more cutting of the search space it does. Okay, when in doubt, think of heuristic values of infinity, because if you consider each of these guys to be infinitely far from the goal, then you can give up right away, because you can't find the goal, so you can be done very fast. Okay, the larger the value, the less the search. Okay. And so we looked at the level-based heuristics and the max heuristic and the sum heuristic, and then we talked about when level-based heuristics fail. The basic idea is that you consider multiple actions in the same level, and so the level is not connected to the number of actions. Okay, unless, of course, you want to somehow compare plans in terms of, you know, cost of the plan in terms of level, but that doesn't make sense. Okay, and so then we get to the relaxed plan heuristic, which we talked about, and then you can greedily extract a relaxed plan, and if you extract it greedily, it would be inadmissible. If you look for the optimal relaxed plan, it would be admissible, but most people who use relaxed plans use greedy extraction. Okay. Okay. Now this is kind of useful to know. One of which is if you are computing these planning graphs multiple times, once for each of these states. Okay. One issue is, can you construct them efficiently? Can you also construct them such that they don't take too much space? And there are all sorts of ways of improving the plan graph construction. One weird thing about planning graphs in general is that they are highly redundant data structures. Okay, it's like in the planning graph, if an action comes at this level, that means it's applicable, then it will always be applicable in every other level after that. Why? Because of the no-op action. Anything that is true here can be persisted to be true in the next level without doing anything. Okay? Because of which, once an action comes into the level, it is available everywhere else. Okay? And so, and same thing for propositions. Once a proposition comes into a level, it's available everywhere else. Okay? So really all you need to know is for each proposition, what is the level at which it came in, and for each action, what's the first level at which it came in. Okay. So in terms of these graphs, you can have a bilevel graph where you just have one set of propositions, one set of actions, and then for each of them there is a number telling the first level at which they came in. That has all the information that you need. And then you write your program for computing the relaxed plan such that it works with this bipartite graph, this bilevel graph, not even bipartite, it's bilevel. Okay. The other thing that a lot of people do is try to use the planning graph actions to reduce the number of actions that you actually consider doing. Okay, so in particular, you can consider only the actions that appear in the planning graph in the search space. So if an action never appears ever in the planning graph, that means it's not applicable, even in the relaxed sense, in any state that is reachable. So you can ignore that. So that kind of can cut down. Okay, and starting from that, you can make the branching, you can reduce the number of actions you're going to look at. For example, the most stringent of those is only consider the actions that appear in the relaxed plan. Okay, of course, when you do that, you lose completeness. This one, if you just consider actions that appear in the planning graph, that doesn't lead to loss of completeness, because if it, something is not present in the planning graph, it can never actually be applicable in any reachable state. Yes? Yeah, but there's too many actions that are applicable. Of them, I will only consider those which satisfy this. That's the whole point. In fact, this is actually quite useful for progression, because you don't, you know, there are many more actions that are applicable. Okay. Yes. Yeah. But the later ones, the relaxed plan, for example, the actions that appear in the relaxed plan, that would cut down.
Yeah.
So.
Is useful. Because you're not going to continually check, is this action applicable at every node? There's a lot of overhead.
Okay.
In extreme case like that.
And actually, in fact, this action selection, cutting down the number of actions during search, winds up being just as important in planner scalability. The FF planner that you would use, and we'll probably read a paper on that sometime, just on the side. Because you at least have one complete system together. And that actually, one of the things that it does is essentially use a very, very restrictive action selection, which reduces the number of actions that are being considered. Okay? And, you know, it's something like, consider the actions that appear in the relaxed plan. Okay. Now, adjusting for negative interactions, up until that point, you basically assume that negative interactions don't matter. Okay. Now, when you consider the negative interactions, essentially what you are saying is, although I'm assuming all the actions can be done together, I also want to go ahead and write down the subsets of actions that cannot be done together. Now, if you do it to the full extent, if you identify every subset of actions that cannot be done together, if you identify every subset of the actions that cannot be done together, and then, you know, propagate that information, then you are, in essence, going to reconstruct the search tree on the upstairs. Okay? And, you know, that picture is actually useful to keep in mind. Where am I? Okay. So one of the things is, these are different states. If you have something in this state and something in this state, that doesn't mean that they are both together possible. Those are two different worlds, right? But when you essentially make the planning graph, what you're doing is unioning these states. So you're sort of removing the membrane separating the states. So it looks as if everything is feasible. So then you have to come out and say, no, no, some subsets are not feasible. The logical end to that information is ultimately reconstructing this completely. Give enough information such that you know that two things can appear together only if there exists an actual physical state where they are appearing together. That means in the end you need to get the state search tree finally. Right? What mutex is, so however, this view gives us a way of starting from here and doing more and more and more interaction analysis. So the advantage is, if I tell you some subsets are not feasible, I did tell you something still. At least you can consider all supersets of that subset as not feasible. If I say P and Q are not feasible, then you know P and Q and R are not feasible. Okay? So think of mutexes as essentially bringing back what you lost when you went from here to here. But if you bring everything back, you pay for it, because this is full search. The advantage is you want to bring a little back. You know, for example, if you only bring binary mutexes, not all binary mutexes, those that can be easily computed back, you know, that's okay. I mean, that's in essence what the propagation of binary mutexes winds up doing. Okay? Back. Okay, so and the advantage of, so in essence what you're looking for is some procedure for marking subsets of actions and propositions as not feasible together. And we, you know, of course one advantage of this mutex propagation procedure that we talk about there, and that actually came up in graph plan planner, which we'll discuss later, is that it provides an incremental way of computing mutual exclusion. Okay? So what you do is you start from the most obvious mutual exclusion. You'll say two actions cannot be done if their preconditions and effects are interfering. So one guy needs P, another guy needs not P. Any idiot can see that they can't be done together. You don't need huge amounts of processing. And similarly, one guy needs P, other guy gives not P. It's clear that you can't do them together. Right? So you start from that. You start from that level. All you basically consider is mark just the actions that are statically interfering. This is considered static interference. That means if their preconditions and effects of one action are inconsistent with the preconditions and effects for other action, where inconsistency is in terms of direct negation. One says P, another says not P. Now starting from that, you can then, this propagation procedure is in essence trying to do a limited inference on top of it. Okay, so what we are saying here is these two guys are, these two guys cannot be done together, because their preconditions are actually violating, you know, sample needs at and drive negates at. So that's why they can't get along. Now, when you come to this level, these two guys, really, the only reason they can't get along, they are not negations of each other. They can't get along because the only way this guy can come is that guy, and the only way this guy can come is this guy. And since those guys can't get along, you can't get along. So that's exactly what the propagation is doing. Okay, and similarly, once you say these two are negated, then any action which requires both of these as preconditions shouldn't even be put in this level, because it's not applicable anymore. And similarly, if you have two actions, one requires this as a precondition, another requires this as a precondition, you may as well go ahead and mark them mutually exclusive, even though they are not statically interfering. Even though they are saying, one guy says, I want have soil, other guy says, I want at something. And suddenly you say, you guys are considered interfering because these two are interfering. Okay, so that's how the mutex propagation works. You essentially start with the obvious and you compute the closure, deductive closure. Okay, one of the interesting things is all the properties, so we'll see later on that as soon as, so one of the interesting things is that if you have a planning graph like this without mutual exclusions, and if you try to extract a relaxed plan, which is basically a subgraph that supports the goals, you can do it without backtracking, right? But it won't actually be a plan for the problem, because this particular plan assumes actions don't have any negative interactions. And so it will try to, it will only work in fact if actions which one requiring P, one requiring not P can be done together. Okay, now suppose you got to this in terms of a heuristic, okay, but really the original reason planning graphs were invented was to try and do planning by just searching for subgraphs of the planning graph. Suppose I make a search strategy which looks for subgraphs of the planning graph, which is valid. So now what is the validity issue? Okay, now clearly relaxed plan is valid in the sense that it is taking actions that support the goals, and any time you put in an action, you take all the preconditions of that action and support it. Now, what's interesting is if I just go and add the static interferences into this graph, nothing else. I don't need to do mutual exclusion propagation. All I need to do is mark every pair of actions that are sworn enemies. Sworn enemies, and everybody knows this. You know, I want P, you want not P, so we can't get along. I want P, you want to delete P, we can't get along. If you only mark those, and then essentially you find a subgraph, which is a subgraph of the structure, such that whenever in that subgraph there are no two actions at any level which are already marked as mutually exclusive. If you can find such a subgraph, you're guaranteed to be sound. All you need to go from relaxed plan to real planning is just marking static interferences. That's it. I'm not talking about whether it can be done efficiently, but it's all, you know, the soundness is important. When you stop, can you be sure that yours is a solution? If you mark static interferences, you're already sure. Now, why does it become hard once you mark static interferences? What happens essentially is once you start carefully constructing the relaxed plan, constructing the planning subgraph to support the goals from one end, and you come all the way here, somewhere you will find, these two actions cannot be part of the plan. So I have to backtrack, pick some other else, come back again. It's that backtracking that ultimately makes it NP-complete to even find a valid subgraph. For relaxed plan, it's polynomial to find a valid subgraph. It's exponential to find the optimal subgraph. Once you throw in the interference relations, it's NP hard to even find the optimal subgraph. Okay. Now, from that point of view, essentially now when you're doing this deductive closure, which is taking these static interferences and propagating it the way I told you, what you're essentially doing is you are doing sort of a constraint propagation from a CSP point of view. So you know some constraints, you're propagating their consequences so that failures that will occur five levels deep would be realized at the first level. And that's great, because if you can fail faster, then the search would be much more efficient. And it's a huge difference. If you take something like graph plan and run it with or without binary mutex propagation, the difference in terms of time it takes to find the plan is significantly larger without mutex propagation. Now, even when I say without mutex propagation, I mean you would mark the static interferences. That you need to do. Without that, you won't even get sound plan. Okay. By the way, what we just said is graph plan. We might look at it again a little later, but really that's what graph plan does. So it computes this planning graph, it marks the static interferences, it propagates the mutexes. Now the only question, of course, is when does it stop? And well, the simple idea is, you know, grow this planning graph to level k, and if you can find a subgraph of this, then you solve the problem. Now you don't know how long to extend it, So one simple idea is to start with 1, 2 levels, 3 levels, 4 levels, 5 levels, 6 levels, etc. And when you stop, when you find a plan, you stop. Now here is my question. Is graph plan optimal? The whatever I just described, is that optimal? So the first level at which finds the plan, it'll stop. Is that going to be optimal? It's going to be optimal for something. It's going to be optimal for the number of levels, because that's what you're looking. But who cares about number of levels? Nobody does. I mean, well, at least not me, and maybe not you. Okay, number of levels is what you are trying to get away from by using relaxed plan heuristics, remember? So graph plan is sort of optimal, but in a kind of an uninteresting way. It's in the number of levels. So to make graph plan optimal in the number of actions, you can do it. With respect to this discussion, you can do it very easily. All you need to do is you say every pair of non-no-op actions are mutually exclusive. Because you can never do more than one action per level. So just go ahead and mark every pair of non-no-op actions mutually exclusive. Plus on top of that, you might also mark some no-op and non-no-op actions mutually exclusive, because one is persisting P, other requires not P. If you do that, you will be optimal. But you won't win the competition, right? So one of the interesting things actually in the planning competition, I mean, I'll send you a link to it, there's this whole controversy. When optimality track was invented originally, a bunch of people who can solve this bounded length planning as the graph plan style planning have gotten in. And they say, look, we are optimal. Now, obviously, they're optimal for something that nobody cares about. And the way the track was run that first time around was they allowed people to say what they're optimal for. Which, you know, if you didn't laugh at it, you are not awake. Because if you allow people, okay, we give you grade at the end of the semester based on your own evaluation of what you have been optimal at. Some guy says, I've been optimal at doing something during the class, you know, like looking at my laptop. Or some guy says, I was optimal in terms of sleeping well in the class. Okay, I need to talk about the one optimality criterion that I care about. Okay, so graph plan is not the graph plan, the efficient version is not optimal for anything that anybody cares about. It is optimal for number of levels. Graph plan can be made optimal for the number of actions if you make level equal to an action. That means each level only one action can appear. To do that, you need to do this really strong thing. Every two non-no-op actions have to be marked mutually exclusive. If you do that, it becomes what's called a serial planning graph. Okay, and it's a bad thing because it requires, you know, a lot more length. You know, finding graph plan can find a plan in, you know, level 2, okay, with 200 actions, whereas the optimal plan is 199 actions with one action at each level. Imagine the depth difference. 2 versus 199 in terms of search. Okay, and one other thing, since we are here, since we talked about graph plan so much, we'll again get to this is foreshadowing, is that when you're looking for subgraphs of a finite structure, this is a finite size graph and you're looking for subgraphs, there are only finite number of subgraphs. It's a classic combinatorial problem. Okay, find a substructure of this structure which has some property. Okay, now you can do this in any which way. You can compile this combinatorial problem into some, you know, you can either write your own C++ program to do that, which actually starts from this side, you know, finds goals, finds actions to support them, finds actions to support their preconditions and goes that way, which is the way graph plan originally did it. Or you could say that, look, here's my graph. I'll write them into a set of constraints in your favorite constraint framework, either CSP or integer programming or SAT. And somebody else has already developed CSP solvers, somebody else has developed IP solvers, somebody else has developed SAT solvers. So let them solve the problem. And in fact, it turns out that those can be much faster than you writing your own program sometimes. In fact, in the case of GraphPlan, it turns out that going this level by level, which is the first idea you can think of, turns out not to be always efficient. Sometimes you are better off starting in the middle of the graph and going it backward. And when you're doing SAT or CSP, in essence, you might be considering, oh, I'll take this action, this action, this action, this action. I'm done. Because there is no directionality, back to front or front to back. Okay? That's the whole thing about bounded length planning. We will look at it again in a separate class. But let me stop here. It's 4:30. What I think we should do next class is I'll say a little bit more about plan space planning, the use of these heuristics for plan space planning. But I'll also send you readings, since we did all this, I'll also send you readings about SAT plan sort of things, which is basically bounded length planning algorithms. Okay? And then we can get that done next slide. Okay.